This is work that I've done with Hong Liu and Urs Wiedemann. Of the three papers we've written, my talk will be describing work in these two. There will be Yiming Shi is an undergraduate at MIT. He's done a small calculation, which you'll see at a certain point. So for the purposes of this talk, given all the other talks we've heard, I'm going to take as given that the quark gluon plasma being produced and studied at RIC, it has an 8 over S that's somewhere not far above 1 over 4 pi, strongly coupled. It's better thought of as a liquid than as a gas. These are all statements that need to be questioned, probed, poked at, but that's what we've been doing so far. I don't want to go back over those questions in this talk. I'm going to take it as given and ask, well, suppose that that's true. What is our response as theorists? How do we calculate the properties of a strongly interacting quark gluon plasma liquid? Well, as far as thermodynamics goes, there's no problem. You can use lattice QCD in the same way as it has always been used. It's the perfect tool for strong interactions for static properties. And so all these iconic plots from lattice QCD of kind of the chiral condensate vanishing with temperature and the number of degrees of freedom going up with temperature as you go into the deconfined state, all these iconic plots are just as good as they always were. But that should already tell you that the fact that the strongly interacting, strongly coupled nature of the plasma was something of a surprise. Tells you you can't infer that from those plots. Anything dynamic, anything changing in time, lattice is not the it has a much harder time dealing with. So you can either use perturbative QCD, which, if we're making the assumption in this talk that the plasma is very strongly coupled and is a liquid with no quasi particles, perturbative QCD is the wrong approximation, but it has the big advantage that you're working at the right theory. Or you can calculate properties of quark gluon plasmas in quote-unquote wrong theories using a better approximation, in other words, starting from strong coupling. So to particle physicists, this notion of doing your calculations with the wrong theory sounds odd. But in condensed matter physics, it's second nature. If you think about an analogy that I like to use, is condensed matter physicists would like to understand high-QC superconductivity. And so they spend all their time studying the Hubbard model. And they certainly do not think that the Hubbard model describes every feature of copper and oxygen atoms. They believe, whether rightly or wrongly, that certain characteristic features of these real systems are captured by this model. And so they're trying to understand the model in order to understand those characteristic features. And that, I think, is the spirit in which we, particle physicists, now turn to looking at other theories with strongly interacting quark gluon plasmas. Unfortunately for us, nature only provides one example of a quark gluon plasma to study, that of QCD. It would be very, very helpful, as in fact is the case in condensed matter physics, to have many examples in the class of strongly interacting non-abelian plasmas. Unfortunately, we don't in experiment, but we do in theory. So we theorists can ask, by studying many quark gluon plasmas, can ask what features are characteristic and what features are uninteresting details. In other words, we can look for quantities that are universal, and we have to define precisely what we mean by universal. So as you all know in this room, theorists are finding many examples of theories which are tractable in the strong coupling limit. The simplest among these is n equals 4. And in all, the idea then is you can compare static properties in these other theories to things you know from lattice QCD, and you can compare dynamic properties to things you are learning from experiments.
But when you eventually compare with experiments, yes, you will have to worry about the uninteresting details.
Absolutely, and that will be the second, that will be the last part of my talk. So, precisely. So if quark gluon plasma, if the quark gluon plasma is a RIC, at RIC is a liquid, then lattice QCD is perfect for its thermodynamics. The reason why these other theories are tractable at strong coupling is that these ADS-CFT methods apply. The two examples of quantities that I'll mention are 8 over S, which we've heard a lot about already, and Q hat, this jet quenching parameter. Both of these are quantities that have been calculated in many, in fact, infinitely many, strongly interacting quark gluon plasmas, but not in QCD. Both turn out to agree better with RIC data than do weak coupling QCD calculations. So maybe 8 over S might be a common characteristic of strongly interacting quark gluon plasmas. And the question that I want to come to is there a parameter that's related to Q hat? In effect, the nice thing with 8 over S is that Policastro, Son, and Starinets figured out what to put downstairs. We would like to know, is there a Q-hat over something which is either literally universal or at least a common characteristic? Okay, so I have to tell you what jet quenching is and what the jet quenching parameter is. Uli already told you what jet quenching is, so I won't show the data at this moment. I'll just show the cartoon. In a heavy ion collision, once in a blue moon, there's a heavy ion collision in which a hard scattering occurs. Most of the time, you don't get hard scatterings, but once in a while, you do. This is a hard scattering which, if it happened in vacuum, would have made a 10 to 20 GeV jet going that way and a 10 to 20 GeV jet going that way. You see one, but when you look on the other side, instead of seeing a 10 to 20 GeV jet, you see an excess of the red stuff. Many people yesterday and later on today will be talking about characterizing more precisely this excess of the red stuff. I want to talk about the energy loss itself, not where the energy goes. And it turns out that when quantified, the effect is bigger than expectations based on perturbative QCD calculations. As I will explain, there's a single parameter called Q hat, which is much larger, required by the data to be much larger than is predicted from perturbative QCD. So let me skip the data, because they're precisely the same figures that Uli showed. Make a first step at telling you what Q hat is. So in the high energy limit, energy loss is dominant in QCD in an asymptotically free theory. So I should say up front, I am not going to calculate jet quenching in n equals 4. Jet quenching in n equals 4 is very different. In n equals 4, the energy loss of a hard parton moving through the plasma can be described as a drag, as HKKKY and G showed. What I'm going to try to do is ask, how do I describe jet quenching in an asymptotically free theory like QCD in the limit where the jet that I'm discussing has arbitrarily high energy? So if I go to the high energy limit, energy loss in QCD, like in QED, is dominated by Bremsstrahlung, except here you Bremsstrahlung off a gluon. And the thing that makes it interesting is that this these hard lines, here's the hard parton, here's the gluon irradiates, are all going through this medium, and this medium has temperature T. So even though I've made this energy arbitrarily large, and in fact, as I make the energy large, this KT gets larger also, so I can go to a regime where E is much bigger than KT is much bigger than T, the physics at scale T, by our hypothesis for today, is strongly coupled. Nevertheless, in this limit, it turns out that the energy loss is sensitive to this strongly coupled medium through one parameter, and you can then develop a formalism to relate. Yes.
Since Q cap is proportional to PT squared that you show, so large value of Q cap is large value of PT squared, shouldn't you expect to get into weak coupling at large Q cap?
Let me show you the actual result for Q hat in a second. You'll see that Q hat actually goes like T cubed times square root of lambda. So Q hat is sensitive to physics at scale T.
Can I just ask a different version of that question?
Perhaps, yes.
Why isn't it sensitive to a saturation scale?
It is. It in fact,
asymptotically free theory.
I'll show you.
Much, much larger than T.
I'll show you. It in fact is the saturation scale. You'll see that in a minute. Exactly. That's going to be on a later transparency. But nevertheless, it's proportional to T cubed. Of the quark gluon plasma in this case. So to make the saturation scale, I'll tell you in a second. I am going to mention that, so let me just go on. So continuing in this introductory mode, I want to give you a sense of the quality or lack thereof of the extraction of the value of this parameter in comparison with data. This is how the experimentalists do it. This is the plot from the Phoenix experiment. So this is a plot of the experimental data being plotted here is this quantity RAA, which you saw yesterday. It's the RAA of 0.2 means that you see one-fifth as many 10 GeV particles as you would expect, in this case, pi zeros as you would expect, assuming PP collisions with no final state interactions. So you've lost 80% of the 10 GeV particles. You then calculate in this perturbative formalism with Q hat as a parameter, you calculate for different values of Q hat what RAA should look like. And what a theorist would do with this is to say, well, it should be roughly 13. What experimentalists do is they make a histogram of the probability. Given that data, this is the probability distribution for what Q hat might be. And you can see here that from the Phoenix analysis, Q hat could be as low as 5, could be as high as 25, and it peaks at around 13, which is what a theorist would have said given this plot.
What is assumed about the dynamics of the condition in these?
That's crucial. So, let me just show the next one. To give you a sense of the further uncertainty, here's a group of theorists attempting to do the same thing. So, it's Jinyan Wang and collaborators. And what they are doing, I have to explain this plot, let's see which way I want it. I want this side. So look only at the right-hand axis and the top axis, and let's start with this bottom curve here. In their model, in their implementation, so loosely speaking, different groups calculate the same Feynman diagrams, and then different groups make different assumptions about how the median evolves. That's the summary, as Uli knows very well. The difference between this calculation and the other one, other than its authors, has to do with assumptions about the dynamics. The point I want to make from this is the following. So this is the chi-squared of the value of q-hat times the parameter tau-naught. Tau-naught is an initial time scale. You would like to think it would be the quantity which Uli evaluates and finds to be 0.6 Fermis, but we don't really know. Could it be 0.4 Fermis? Could it be 1 Fermi? Yes. This is one way of parameterizing one's ignorance of the dynamics. If I imagine tau is a half, then q hat, then this being 3 means q hat is 6 GV squared for Fermi. And this is a plot of the chi-squared distribution for q hat times tau naught, given as input only the data that I used before, namely RAA. And you see that it's a very flat distribution. This is not, so if you say I want chi-squared less than 4, for example, you're allowed to go out to very large values of q hat. This one here is the same idea, but in addition to using the suppression of single high-energy particles, it uses the two-particle correlation information, which is called IAA on the plot. And when you use that, what you should see is that your determination tightens up a little bit and is centered now at about, it's centered here, this is about 2.5, so it's centered actually at about 5. If I take tau out of a half, it's q out of around 5 dB squared for Fermi. So the dust has not settled yet. I think the experimentalists, when they did it the way that I showed, wanted to be conservative, and they did think to try and, when they made choices, they made them such as to make the range as wide as, if they had choices to make, they always made the choices to make the allowed range of Q hat wider. The theorists try and squeeze it down a little bit. The dust has yet to settle. To give you an example, I don't have this on a transparency, but to give you an example, crucial to doing this correctly is to have a distribution of L's, the distance traveled. If you take the same Feynman diagram, so the same calculation of jet quenching, and pretend that every jet that's quenched travels 6 Fermis, then when you fit to the same data, you pull out a Q out of 1 GV squared per Fermi, not 5 to 25. And when you do the calculation, as this is low PQM, stands for partron quenching model, and it's low IZDs at L, when you do the calculation as low IZDs at L, then you get a distribution of L's, and you find that the typical distances traveled are more like 1 to 2 Fermis, not 6. And so because the distances of traveled are shorter, you get a larger Q hat.
Because we only see those.
Right. So you can get small values of Q hat if you make erroneous dynamical assumptions. Okay. So this perturbative formalism that leads to those plots is developed by many people. I am not one of them. But what they have done is to calculate the gluon radiation spectrum, the spectrum of radiated energy in this diagram, and show that it can be related to Q hat, where Q hat is the transverse momentum squared picked up by that gluon right here per distance traveled. As formalism to repeat assumes that E and K perp are large, so it assumes that E is much bigger than KT, is much bigger than T. And at RIC, this is dubious, because at RIC, you don't have a lot of scales to play with, given that E is at most 20 GeV. Once we get to the LHC, there'll be more room for this. There'll be more room for separation of scales, given that we'll be talking about 200 GeV jets. In this E goes to infinity limit, the Parkland energy loss is sensitive to the medium, to the physics, only through this one parameter Q hat. If you ask, what is your perturbative intuition? So what if that medium were weakly coupled? Then, and only then, Q hat can be written as divide mass squared over mean free path. And that goes like number density of scatterers times the dimensionless measure of the cross section. When evaluated by these folks, it turns out to be alpha squared nc squared t cubed times the number, which is around 1 GeV squared per Fermi. And that's too small to fit the data. So what we need is a strong coupling calculation of Q hat. And before you can think about that, you need a non-perturbative definition. This really was provided by Wiedemann. In a sense, the three of us were highlighted it, but it really was provided by Ors. Ors noticed some years ago that the quantity Q hat can be defined as follows. Consider a light-like Wilson loop, which has, so it goes along the light cone, some long distance L minus. It then goes a short distance L, which comes out of the board. Okay, so L is, I can't draw it very well, but the short side L is sticking out of the board. And then it goes back down the light cone, and then it closes. And assuming that this long distance L minus is much, much larger than the short distance L, then it turns out that the expectation value of this Wilson loop is proportional to d to the minus q hat times L squared. Now, what is this L? This L should be chosen to be of order 1 over kt. In other words, much, much less than 1 over the temperature. And the statement is that what is the statement not? The statement is not that we've done a non-perturbative calculation and derived this result non-perturbatively. That's not the statement. The statement is that BDFPS and Wiedemann and many others developed a perturbative formalism. And in that perturbative formalism, the quantity Q hat, which arises in jet quenching, is the same quantity Q hat which arises in this Wilson loop. And we then said, well, we know how to calculate this Wilson loop non-perturbatively, so let's just do that. That's the statement.
But the definition, here comes my serious question.
Yeah.
So in this Wilson line, the two lines are the lines which Solnit just described.
No, they're not. Okay, good. So you're going to ask about time ordering.
How do we know about that?
Yeah, so you were going to ask about time ordering. So I was going
to.
Yeah, right. It's the answer is. Oh, where was I going to say this? I had a transparency precisely for this point. Here it is. So I'll take this out of order. I'll have to come back to it. So Q hat is not kappa T, and kappa T is not Q hat. So actually, I won't compare to Son's talk. I'll compare to Derek Tini's talk yesterday. Derek gave a very nice description of the derivation of the quantity kappa T. Kappa T is you have a single heavy quark moving with velocity, some velocity v to the medium, and it's picking up transverse momentum as it goes. And kappa T describes how that happens. The point you're asking about is down here, but let me do the whole transparency. It turns out that, as Steve and Derek and Jorge showed, that you can only do that calculation kappa T if the velocity is smaller than something. Turns out that if the square root of the Lorentz gamma is less than something which is given there, then you can find a single quark with a dragging string, and you can compute kappa T. Kappa T turns out to be proportional to the square root of gamma, so it diverges for large gamma. On the other hand, Q hat is defined by a light-like Wilson loop. So you have to take gamma to infinity and m to infinity, keeping square root of gamma bigger than this quantity. This transparency is out of order. But the question that, Edward, you're asking is, what about time ordering? And
because again, I
right.
have only one quark in the amplitude and one in the
okay. The answer, the right. No, actually, you do. The answer is, in a sense, you do have two quarks. Let me just keep going. I can't do this out of order. I have to do it in the order I was put to it. I just realized that I cannot do it out of order. Sorry. Okay. So how do I calculate the jet quenching parameter in n equals 4 super Young Mills from ADS CFT? First thing I use is that at large n, the adjoint Wilson loop is the square of the fundamental. Next thing I use is that a prescription going back to Maldacena and company That the excitation value of the fundamental Wilson loop is e to the I s, where s is the action of an extremized world sheet in the five-dimensional ADS black hole metric, and it's the world sheet whose boundary at r equals infinity is the contour C, the Wilson loop contour that I'm trying to evaluate. As by now you've seen many times, r is the fifth dimension. At a location r naught, there's a black hole horizon. The gauge theory temperature is related to the black hole temperature. The Etoff coupling in the gauge theory is related to the string tension. And 1 over lambda over nc is given by, is related to the string coupling. So you should now be noticing that Maldesainis' prescription wrote the expectation value like this, and we're looking for a result like this. That means that S has to be imaginary. It means we expect and find an extremal string world sheet that is space-like. In contrast, in the more familiar calculation of screening, if you put your Wilson loop along the time direction instead of along the light cone, then the excitation value becomes, it looks like e to the I times the duration, capital tau here, times some energy, and that is, you can describe as the static potential between two heavy quarks. So we now ask what happens upon boosting the loop. Pong in his talk is going to tell you the first part of this story. And in other words, what happens when you boost the loop a little bit. But if you boost the loop until, boost until that Wilson loop is light-like, you should no longer be thinking of a QQ bar meson. Instead, by the time that that Wilson loop is light-like, you can think of this Wilson loop as the as the QQ bar Fock state of a virtual photon. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold, which is starting to presumably be audible. So if I now think of a different calculation where instead of an infinite quark gluon plasma, I have some finite object like a nucleus or a nucleon, so my medium now is that, then this is a well-established way of calculating this photoabsorption cross-section in deep elastic scattering. And the relationship between the excitation value of the Wilson loop and the photoabsorption cross-section in deep elastic scattering only makes sense if the Wilson loop goes like e to the minus a real quantity. In other words, that S has to turn out to be imaginary. And in this context, the quantity Q hat times L minus is called Q saturation squared. So the Q hat that we calculate, you could if we could do the calculation of Q hat for a hadron, we would be calculating the saturation scale of that hadron. That's not what we know how to do. What we're doing is the calculation of Q hat for quark gluon plasma. So you can think of what we're doing as calculating the saturation scale for the quark gluon plasma. The saturation scale for the quark gluon plasma would depend on the extent of quark gluon plasma that you have. The bigger the volume of it, the more you have. So the way that the saturation scale gets large is that Q hat times L minus gets large. Okay. Q hat, you'll see, goes like TQ, but Q at L minus can get large as L minus gets large. And this is the answer to the question that various of you were asking before. Okay, so, well, if we knew how to calculate Q, this expectation value of a light like Wilson loop in a background that represented a hadron, we would go do it. We don't know how to do that, so we do it in a quark gluon plasma. Now I can come to the comparison I was trying to make out of order. So the calculation we are doing requires that the velocity of this Wilson loop be at the speed of light, and in particular, it requires to be bigger than this quantity. If you're on the other side of this divide, then as various people in the room show, you can construct a solution with a single quark moving along and a dragging string. You can calculate kappa t. As Derek and Jorge showed very nicely, if you try and go extend this picture to here, it breaks down because you end up having to exert a sufficient force, the force that you need to exert to try and exceed this velocity gets so large that you start having unsuppressed pair production. The string tension goes to zero. So on this side of this divide, you can talk about kappa t, you can talk about screening. On this side of the divide, where you have Eichnell physics, you can talk about the saturation scale, or you can talk about Q hat. And now, this is where I was going to talk about this, so some of the things I've already said. It turns out, and I don't have this on transparency, I'll just say, if you look in the BDMPS formalism, and you ask, the question is, where's my loop? The question, Edward, that you're asking is, if you look in the BDMPS formalism, and you look on this Wilson loop, In order for this, in order for what you get to be legitimately called the Wilson loop, the two following things have to be true. Color indices have to be in path order. You have to get the color indices to go. You can track color indices along the path. But time ordering has to be time ordering. So in other words, if I'm talking about this point on the loop here and this point on the loop here, the time ordering has to be according to this time here.
Because if one line is in amplitude and another that amplitude,
right.
What is the time ordering of the two?
I'll tell you. What happens,
it makes no sense.
In fact, it comes about because of the way you do the calculation. So here's the cut. Here's this hard gluon. And here's all the soft scatterings. And here in the conjugate amplitude, here's the hard gluon. And here's all the soft scatterings. And the point is that this is the conjugate amplitude of this, which means that if you take into account the momentum of this and this, it's as if these have to be joined across the cut. It's as if these have to be joined across the cut. It's as if these have to be joined across the cut. No, in longitude, they have the same longitudinal position. In the BDNPS formalism, this and this, you integrate, these momenta are integrated over, so they have the same longitudinal position. And it's because they have the same longitudinal position, they have the same light cone time, they have the same position along the light cone. That's what tells you that what you guys are working with. This is done in full detail in papers by Oars from about 4 or 5 years ago, and they are very long papers, which I find hard to read. But once you're looking for it, it is there. It's perturbative.
It's a perturbative green function.
Of course. That's what I said. And you do a perturbative calculation. You find that what arises is the Wilson loop. We then calculate the Wilson loop non-perturbatively. But what arises is the Wilson loop. It's not some Schwinger-Keldysh conflict. Period.
No, it was Schwinger-Keldysh. You say he showed the answer is the same.
He showed that the answer is the Wilson loop, not the Schwinger-Keldysh. They differ, and he showed that it's the Wilson loop.
Okay. So once again, your difference you're saying is that the Wilson loop is time ordered on both legs. Did I hear you right?
Where's my Wilson loop? I think what I'm going to say right now is this is a completely technical point, which is very well established in 4-year-old literature, and we shouldn't be spending the time of my talk on it.
This is
This follows the ADS rule. We're not doing a calculation of a correlation function of the kind that Song and Derek talked about in their talks. We're calculating a Wilson loop, and we're following the ADS CFT calculation rules for a Wilson loop.
Calculate Quarkonian. Quarkonian, you're fine.
No, it's not Quarkonian because we're on the light cone. You can't have. If we were off the light cone to the left hand side, no, that's not true whatsoever. If you were. It is exactly Quarkonian on this side of the boundary. This is Quarkonian. This is not. This is a virtual QQ bar. This is a QQ bar component of the Fock state of a virtual photon. If you want to call that Quarkonian, that's fine.
Okay, but this is not the problem of chip
rate. It is.
No.
It is.
You're have only one part.
You're not listening to me, Edward. Let me finish. I am not calculating n equals 4 energy loss. I'm not calculating that. I'm calculating Q hat. And Q hat is defined as the Wilson loop.
But then we don't know how it is related to anything.
We do. We have this whole formalism, which at least we do perturbatively. Right. We know perturbatively how it's related to anything. That's correct. The idea is that we're doing a non-perturbative calculation, so you have a perturbative calculation of energy loss in QCD. That has one parameter which is sensitive to physics of the medium. And we don't know how to calculate that perturbatively. So we are now calculating that quantity non-perturbatively in...
Fine, I understand. So if the momenta are large, so the perturbative calculation is justified, you are fine.
Exactly.
But if not, then no.
Correct. Absolutely. We require that the energy of the jet be large, and the energy of the kt of the radiated gluon be large, so E bigger than kt bigger than t. And all of that is controlled in the high energy limit, because in the high energy limit, it all works. Whether it works at RIC, who knows? But it's what all of the people who compare jet quenching data to Q hat are all doing that. Are all using that? And as Uli explained, I don't want to go into it. I will mention at the end. I'll mention at the end the caveat. Okay, so I need to go. I need to skip the how we did the calculation now. So here's my Wilson loop coming out of the board along the light cone. I've sliced it at one value of light cone time. You have to write down the Nambu-Goto action for the spring world sheet. You need to evaluate it. You need to solve the Lorentz-Saltz equations of motion that come from it and derive this shape. You discover that this string world sheet comes down and kisses the horizon, regardless of what the value of L is. You then do the evaluation, skip steps because of lost time, and pull out the small L behavior, and there's your Q hat. So after you've done this calculation, what have you got? Well, you have Q hat in a different theory. The theory with strongly interacting gauge to do with it. It's a strongly interacting plasma, but it's a different one. It's of course, a theory in which 8 over S is 1 over 4 pi. We've got the Q hat at the strong coupling limit, and it turns out to be T cubed times square root of lambda times the number, which we've calculated. And the first interesting thing is that Q hat does not turn out to be proportional to S or to the number density of scatterers. Those both go like nc squared times t cubed, and there's no nc squared hiding in them. Second of all, when you try numbers just for fun, you get at the temperature of 300 MeV, which is the benchmark I'm using for making estimates, and it's not so far off what you get from hydrodynamics for Rick collisions at time 1 Fermi, you get a Q hat of 5 instead of 1. 1 was the perturbative result. Here we got 5 at the same temperature and the same value of alpha. So Q hat in this wrong theory is comparable to what seems to be needed by the dub. So obviously there are issues here. What are the issues? So what are the issues? We found that Q hat in the wrong theory of strong coupling is comparable to that required by the data. So what are the issues on both sides of this comparison? So first of all, on the data side, the extraction of Q hat from data neglects the possibility that at Rick, maybe energy loss is not entirely dominated by gluon radiation. We know that gluon radiation does dominate for high enough energy jets, but does Rick provide us with high enough energy jets? Quite possibly the answer is no. And the data on heavy quark energy loss, which fully described, indicates that you need to include elastic energy loss. That issue will resolve itself at the LHC, where we'll have 10 times higher energy jets. We'll start to be able to see jets and study their modifications, so we'll have more discriminating observables. We'll start to be able to, for example, study an event where instead of seeing a jet on the near side, you see a Z boson. Z bosons don't lose energy. So you'll know, if you have a Z jet event, you'll know the initial energy of the away side jet. You can then study how it's modified, knowing what its initial energy was. So for those of you who are used to looking forward to the LHC, because it will teach us about electric symmetry breaking, it will also enormously improve our understanding of jet functions. Now, what about issues on the theory side? That's what I'll spend the rest of my time on. So these two theories are different. Various people have enumerated the important differences already. There are some unimportant differences. The fact that one is supersymmetric, the other is not, doesn't matter at high temperature. The fact that QCD has confinement at low temperature doesn't matter because we're talking about the confined phase. But there are a number of important differences between the theories, important in the quark-gluon plasma. So first of all, number of degrees of freedom differ. QCD has adjoint and fundamental degrees of freedom adding up to 47.5 if you count the way they occur in the entropy. N equals 4 has only adjoint degrees of freedom adding up to 120. So loosely speaking, N equals 4 has too few fundamentals and too many adjoints. So what we need is observables that are insensitive to this. Various people have said this in various ways. So 8 over S is the prime example. We'd like to find, to see whether there's a way of scaling the effects of this difference out Q hat also. This difference may sound drastic, but remember that these liquids have no quasi particles anyway. If we were in a weakly coupled system, then this would be telling us about the differences between the quasi particles of the two theories. Here we're in a strongly interacting liquid, so it seems possible, and 8 over S shows that it can be so, that you can just scale this difference away if you think of the intelligent scaling. The N equals 4 theory is conformal. QCD is not. But there's a regime of temperatures starting somewhere around 2 TC and going up to we don't know how far, where the quark gluon plasma thermodynamics, at least, seems quite conformal. So many people have shown the energy over T to the fourth plots just to vary things. I'll show the sound velocity. I think actually this was shown too. And I'll just point out that when you see a sound velocity which somewhere around 2 TC is approaching one-third, that might mean that the system is becoming weakly interacting. But it also might mean that the system is staying very strongly interacting and is becoming better and better approximated as conformal. All that this tells you is that the system is getting conformal. It doesn't tell you whether it's conformal strongly interacting or conformal weakly interacting. So we'd like to know how important is the deviation of conformality that we see in QCD, in the QCD quark gluon plasma. How important is that for QF? Of course, these calculations are done in the large NC and large isotropic limits. We'll come back to one of those in a second. So taking the first of those, I want to see how well can we do, at least in the present day, of going from Q hat in N equals 4 theory to Q hat in QCD. So Hong and Orz and I have shown the following. That in any conformal field theory with a gravity dual, the ratio of Q hat in this any conformal field theory you're interested in to Q hat in N equals 4 is given by the ratio of the square roots of their entropy density. So loosely speaking, Q hat goes like square root of entropy density, not like entropy density. This is a rigorously demonstrated statement in the NC squared to infinity and G squared to NC to infinity limit. It's a rigorously true statement for conformal theory. Showing it, basically, any conformal theory has a metric which looks like ADS5 plus the metric for some internal space, which would be S5 for if it were N equals 4, times an overall warp factor. And basically, demonstrating this result requires showing that if you mess with that internal space, for example, if you orbifold it, if you take the S5 and orbifold it by C2, that changes Q hat by a factor of root 2, while it changes S by a factor of 2. And you can show that more generally than just for orbifold. Yes?
When the string is dangling in one of these non-trivial backgrounds,
yes.
What if its orientation those extra dimensions affect its tension?
I will show you. Okay, so I'll take another transparency out of order. And I will show you a very useful result due to Alex Bouchel and others for how to calculate Q hat, and then you can tell me whether this answers your question. This is a very useful result. If you have any theory whose metric has the following form, then where y are the coordinates of the internal M5, then the jet quenching parameter is given by 1 over Q hat by 1 over pi alpha times this interval, where R naught is the horizon. And this is something which Alex showed and was essentially simultaneously a little bit later shown by these other authors. Does this answer your question? Can you answer from this?
I would think surely that you would need to know the dilatant, unless that's the string metric.
This is the string metric. So, and actually, the alpha, yeah, this is all about, the relation comes actually in relating alpha prime to square root of lambda. That's where the volume of the M5 comes in. And that's actually where this result comes from.
And so that's supposed to be a y-independent Q hat at the end of the day?
Suppose you have an M5 with inequivalent points in it, and you do one Q hat where I put the D3 brain at one place in the M5, and I do another Q hat where I put the D3 brain at a different place in Q hat. Those can differ.
All right, that was my question.
Okay. Can I finish my talk? Okay. So this result. First of all, it confirms that weak coupling intuition is not a good guide, because the weak coupling intuition suggests that Q hat should be proportional to the number of degrees of freedom. And here you see, surely, if that's true, it's not. Second of all, it suggests that in a non-conformal theory, we make the following conjecture, I'm going to take q hat, and I'm going to write it as t cubed times square root of lambda, and in a non-conformal theory, lambda will depend on t. And I'm going to call the rest, whatever this rest is, I'm going to call it square root of a. This equation defines a quantity a. And the conjecture is that this quantity a is proportional to the number of degrees of freedom, even in a non-conformal theory. And furthermore, hence, it decreases along a normalization of flows, which is why we call it a. So if you buy this conjecture, and this is just a conjecture, then we would know how to relate q out of qcd to q out of n equals 4, at least how to take into account the difference in number of degrees of freedom, and it would be a factor of 0.6. But this is a pure conjecture. We need evidence for it, and the evidence for it at present is thin. This is really the best evidence for it, and it's not a very good example because it involves changing the number of dimensions of space. But if you do the calculation for the DP brains with p equals 2 and 4 instead of 3, this works. You find q hat going like square root of the thing which occurs in S. So this supports the conjecture, but it's a rather contrived example. What we would like is better examples, and that will be on my wish list at the end. Now, what about corrections due to non-conformality? Here we have two examples which suggest that they are small. So what I'd like to do here, the ideal here, and this is, these examples don't satisfy this ideal, but the ideal would be to make the theory non-conformal without affecting its number of degrees of freedom. What I'm imagining doing is asking first, how does number of degrees of freedom change q hat? Then how does non-conformality change it? Of course, it's not really possible to do this separation cleanly. But here are two examples which address the question of, which allow you to get a sense of how important is the non-conformality of QCD to q hat. So in this first example, which is due to Alex showed that if you calculate q hat for the cascading gauge theory, Klebanov-Strassler is chaos, then it's related to the q hat of the conformal Klebanov-Witten theory by this factor here. And I should say this is square root of 27 over 16 is a number of degrees of freedom factor. So here you can see the idea. This is the dependence on number of degrees of freedom. This is the dependence on non-conformality. And the way that Alex parameterized the non-conformality was in terms of the deviation of the speed of sound from 1/3. And if I take the speed of sound as 0.28, which is what QCD lattice calculations tell us it is at around 1.5 TC, then for this value of the speed of sound, the effect on q hat is a 15% effect. Now, here's another way of doing the same kind of estimate. Kao and collaborators introduced an ABS QCD model whose thermodynamics they studied at length. So this is no longer a theory where you can say this is dual to such and such a field theory. This is now a model. And if I look at the high temperature metric in Kao's paper, it's the ABS black hole metric modified by a non-trivial dilaton. And there's a constant C in their paper, which they spend 2/3 of their paper discussing. And this, but for our purposes, this C is a parameter which parameterizes non-conformality. If I put C equals 0, I have the old story. And they did a lot of work to decide what they thought was a good value of C to describe, to model QCD. You have to read their paper, or maybe Kay will talk about it. Very, very loosely speaking, you can think of it as spinning to data, but it's more non-trivial than that. So we can then do, in fact, Yeming Shi has done the straightforward thing to do, which is to calculate the jet quenching parameter in this metric, and what we find, and you can see that it does depend on C over T squared, as you would expect. And for temperature of 300, you get an 8-9% effect. For temperature of 200, you get an 18% effect. Again, the amount, so this is another indication that the amount of non-conformality in QCD is going to change things at the a few tens of percent level, not drastically. Completely as an aside, Yeming has also calculated the drag coefficient, and it turns out that there is no longer a drag coefficient. Mu of p is now p-dependent once you introduce the non-conformality.
Wish list.
Okay. Wish list is the next transparency after this one. So, last thing about which I have something to say, as opposed to a wish list, is, well, what value of lambda should you use? What is lambda in the quark-gluon plasma direct? This is something we discussed at length yesterday. Here's my version of that discussion, one transparency. So what I would say is what we need is a quantity that is, first of all, calculable non-perturbatively in QCD. Second of all, calculable in n equals 4 at finite lambda, not just at lambda goes to infinity. And third of all, that does not depend on number of degrees of freedom. Because, again, the way I'm thinking about this is I would like to separate out effect of number of degrees of freedom from effect of strength of complex. And so the classic example that's been around for many years now is to use lattice estimates of the ratio of the, say, for example, energy density over the non-interact energy density, and compare that to Steve's calculation and pull out a value of lambda. And I will just, I said this already yesterday, I will just mention that there's a new option that's just coming onto the into view. Harvey Meyer has revolutionized the calculation of something like A over S by an algorithmic advance that allows him to calculate the relevant Euclidean correlator with 50 times greater precision than before. And as you heard in Song's talk, you need precise lattice data to have a chance at doing this extraction. He now has precise lattice data for the first time. You can read how he does the extraction in the paper. He extracts values of A over S at two temperatures. If you plug those values of A over S into Bouchel, Liu, and Starnitz evaluation of how A over S depends on lambda in n equals 4, you get lambdas which are broadly consistent with these lambdas. The most important thing about Meyer's lattice results is that they are a first step. The error bars will shrink. He did his calculation that's published in the paper on 8 PCs. He's now using a blue gene. That means that within months, he'll have a higher temperature. He'll have finer lattice spacing. He'll have larger volume. He'll have better extrapolations. He may even have other values of NC. He'll have a calculation of the bulk viscosity. All of that is accessible on the timescale of months. OK, wish list. What we really want and don't have is an example where I can calculate Q hat as I push the theory around in a way that reduces the number of degrees of freedom. So obviously, we would love to be able to calculate Q hat in n equals 2 star. I'm hoping to talk to Alex here to find out where he is in the analysis of n equals 2 star. He's the world expert, and I hope he can teach us how to do this calculation. We would like examples where of calculation of Q hat where the Korteweg plasma includes fundamentals as well as adjoints. We'd like corrections to the g squared to nc limit for Q hat. One contribution has been calculated and is a 2% effect, but it's only one of the two kinds of contributions to this correction, to the leading correction, so this is not done. And of course, as all of us would, we'd love to have corrections to the nc squared to infinity limit. Let me just say that these first three bullets, this one, and this one, are done for 8 over s. For 8 over s, you have all of these, and you can see how 8 over s depends on all these variables. Only this one is missing. I believe that for Q hat, all of these three are accessible, but they're not yet done. The last one is that big wish. So to end, suppose that a year from now, after we've got the Q hat in many gauge theories with dual descriptions, suppose we were to conclude that, as suggested by the result for all conformal theories, suppose we were to conclude that Q hat over root lambda divided by S over NC squared is universal, in the same sense that A over S is. Maybe not that. Maybe that's too much to suppose. So if not that, suppose that we understand enough after playing with enough theories to write Q hat as square root of lambda times T cubed times square root of some A, and we believe that we understand the physics well enough to estimate the product of A times lambda at the factor of 4 levels. And this, I think, is realistic. This might not happen. But if we get to the realistic point, that will already have a big impact. Because if we know square root of A times lambda at the factor of 4 level, then Q hat becomes a thermometer with a calibration error of only 2 to the 1/3. Q hat then becomes a way of measuring T cubed. And that would then allow us to measure, to use jet quenching to measure T, and hence energy over T to the 4th, and test the lattice calculations from which this whole business began 20 years ago. So that would be, it would have an enormous impact on heavy ion physics. What about larger impacts? What are we learning from all this? I think I will leave this up and take one.
Thank you.
So did I see right that Q hat QCD is estimated as 0.63 times Q hat of n equals 4?
Yes.
So 3 GeV squared per centimeter meter if we start with 5.
Correct. Absolutely. And in fact, and to make it even better, if we believe, I mean, you should always believe experimentalists. But if we ignore the experimentalists and believe the theorists, you'd usually not lie. If you ignore the experimentalists and believe the theorists, and furthermore, just because of our base 10 prejudice for numbers that are round to base 10, suppose that tau is 1 Fermi. Then, of course, this plot says that what you're extracting from data is a QM that's around 3 GV squared per Fermi. So it works. It works beautifully if you trust the theorists and put 1 Fermi for tau. This is the level at which dust is not yet settled. The LHC will improve the situation enormously on the experimental side, and the calculations that I just described should help. I won't say improved enormously. Should help on the theory side.
This question is more interesting. Does anybody know where this funny critical velocity comes from?
Yeah, that's going to be the subject of Hong's talk, last talk of the day.
This Q hat is assumed, as you said correctly, is extracted assuming that radiative energy loss dominates.
Absolutely.
If we know that positional energy loss, at least for the heavy quarks, is as important as radiative energy loss.
I think no is too strong a word there, but anyway.
Well, yes, there are strong indications. And the other thing that I shortly mentioned in my talk is that this radiative energy, this Q hat is based on an analysis in which the radiative energy loss is calculated by taking the medium as a bunch of static scatterers. And if you replace that by dynamical scatterers, that tends to increase the energy loss again by a factor of the order of 2. So we have two factors of 1.5.
But those are the same factor, really. Those are the same thing.
No, they are not the same thing. They are not the same thing.
if you
take the calculation as it stands for radiative energy loss, elastic energy loss is exactly zero.
So let me say it a little bit differently.
You have to make the medium dynamic in order to have elastic scattering loss, and that also affects the radiative energy loss. And so both of these effects move in the direction of increasing energy loss based on perturbative analysis. So it's moving closer to data. So my question is, if you add this kind of physics to the strong coupling limit, I would also expect it to move to have the same sign of the effect, at least, maybe not the same magnitude, which would move you further away from the data on the other side.
Well, so let me say a few things that I think you'll agree with. First of all, the situation will clarify with data from the LHC.
Yes.
Second of all, the way I would say the same thing that you said, but in a more theoretical way, is to say that in the high energy limit, where you can trust the Eichnell approximation, then you get what I said. That basically, if you abstract from this BDNPS business, what is it that you need? You need to trust the Eichnell approximation, and that is valid in the high energy limit. The way I would say it is that when you're not in the limit, so if you're at some energy which is not infinite, then you are not just sensitive to one parameter of the medium. You're sensitive to Q hat, which is defined by the Wilson loop, but you're also you start being sensitive to other things, other properties of the medium, like, for example, how its constituents, whatever they are, recoil. You're not sensitive to that in the high energy limit because it just becomes an Eichnell calculation. And so at RIC, surely a calculational framework where you assume that you're sensitive to only one parameter has to be missing important facts. And whether we understand those facts well enough to correct for them, I'm not sure that we do. But I'll end with saying that the LHC will improve the situation.
Yes, the point that you made is that by neglecting that there are these other physics effects and blaming everything on Q hat, you may be introducing a puzzle into the picture that is not there originally.
Although I will counter that by saying that the people like Ivan Vita, who claim that they could fit the data with a small Q hat, are doing so with an L fixed at 6 Fermis. And that is complete and utter garbage.
I agree.
I mean, 6 Fermis is the longest. You know, here's a 7 Fermi circle. You know, here's a 7 Fermi circle. The greatest distance you can travel is 7 Fermis. If you're saying that everybody travels 6 Fermis, it doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, if you need a Q out of 1 GeV to fit the data by assuming L of 6 Fermis, then as soon as you make a realistic geometry assumption,
why do you beat a dead horse?
Your L's go down, your Q hat goes up.
Okay, we need to move on to the next slide. Thank you very much.